what the book says. I'm quoting from the Bible, guys, so, you know. Many of us needed an overhauling there, but above all, we tried to be sensible on this question. It's so easy to get way off the track. Here we find human opinions running to extremes, absurd extremes, perhaps. One set of voices cry that sex is a lust of our lower nature, a base necessity of procreation. Then we have the voices who cry for sex and more sex, who bewail the institution of marriage, who think that most of the troubles of the race are traceable to sex causes. They think we do not have enough of it, or that it isn't the right kind. They see its significance everywhere. One school would allow a man no flavor for his fare, and the other would have us all on a straight pepper diet. We want to stay out of this controversy. We do not want to be the arbitrator of anyone's sex conduct. It's interesting that the book says we do not want to be the arbitrator of anyone's sex conduct, and yet people at AA meetings have taken it upon themselves that the opening words out of their mouths to the newcomer is "don't get emotionally involved." Yeah. Very interesting. I thought this was the authority. That's what I've been told ever since I came here. Everybody kept saying it's in the book. That's what the book says. We do not want to be the arbitrator of anyone's sex conduct. We all have sex problems. We'd hardly be human if we didn't. What can we do about them? We reviewed our own conduct over the years past. Where had we been selfish, dishonest, or inconsiderate? Whom had we hurt? Did we unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? Where were we at fault? What should we have done instead? We got this all down on paper and looked at it. Page 69, guys, if you're wondering. Interesting choice of pages for this topic, but... Right, that's how it worked out for the printer. You know, most people I know, unless pushed to do it, will not take that inventory. Most people I've known over the years in AA will not take a sex inventory unless pushed to do it. I mean driven on by their sponsors. Bring it tomorrow or you will be struck drunk. And then they show up with it. Otherwise, it's like, well, you know, I mean, you know, why do that? My problem is now. Maybe the problem you got now, sucker, is based on some of what went on before. And you see, there's a line in this book that really applies to all of this that it says here on sex. It says very clearly in the big book, we must get rid of all of our old ideas. So if you don't inventory where you were at and what was going on when you were out there with your sex life, how the hell do you expect to know what old ideas you have that you need to get rid of? You know, I mean, I don't know how you can know them. I sure as hell couldn't. Anyway, it says, in this way, speaking of that inventory, we tried to shape a sane and sound ideal for our future sex life. We subjected each relation to this test. Was it selfish or not? We asked God to mold our ideals and to help us live up to them. We remembered always that our sex powers were God-given and therefore good, neither to be used lightly or selfishly, nor to be despised and loathed. Whatever our ideal turns out to be, we must be willing to grow toward it. Doesn't say achieve it immediately. It says grow toward whatever concept you personally hold to as proper sexual conduct. And it varies from moment to moment. True, it does. You know, you might as well face it and be realistic about it. When the beast arises, you know, you can scrap all your best intentions. You will find yourself saying things you hadn't even intended to say. Oh, hello there. How are you? You know, would you like to take a stroll? Just want to study nature. We must be willing to make amends where we have done harm, provided that we do not bring about still more harm in so doing. In other words, we treat sex as we would any other problem. In meditation, we ask God what we should do about each specific matter. The right answer will come if we want it. God alone. Once again, out of this thing, God alone can judge our sex situation. Interesting, considering we have panels in every AA meeting I have ever been in black robes, they're judging our sex on us. Counsel with persons is often desirable, but we let God be the final judge. We realize some people are as fanatical about sex as others are loose. We avoid hysterical thinking or advice. Simple enough. It goes on another page and a half. I think that, you know, that says it for me. Maybe not for you. But it sums it up for me. When it says that God is alone is going to be the judge. Not you. There's nobody in this room qualified to judge my conduct. You may think you are, but you're not. Nobody. And I am not qualified to judge yours. Okay? Now, if I can quit judging yours, and you can quit judging mine, then we both can free each other up to go have a good time. Whatever we individually may consider a good time. But if you're going to busy yourself with my business, and I'm going to busy myself with your business, eventually we won't have any sex left to worry about anyway. You know, we're going to be so involved minding each other's business, there ain't going to be nothing going on to worry about. I won't have to write any inventory on it because I'll be sitting home alone, worrying about what you're doing. Making phone calls to keep track of your actions. I wonder what he's up to now. He really is a son of a bitch. He abuses women. Now, back to the line, don't get emotionally involved. That's a great line. I don't know where the hell it came from. Don't know who came up with it. And I'm sure it probably has, like everything, some practical purpose in somebody's life somewhere. Okay? I have yet to be closely involved personally with anybody that I have worked with on the program that applied to. I have yet to be involved closely, personally, with anyone I have worked with on the program that has found it possible not to get emotionally involved. All of my babies, regardless of their background, penitentiary, atascadero, criminally insane, homicide, murder, badass, no good, insane motherfuckers can fall in love holding hands during the Lord's Prayer. Okay? So you can't tell him not to get emotionally involved. They can plan a whole career with a lady on the crossing signal. All they need is one dance. During 1 3-minute dance, they can get married, have 2.3 children, buy a station wagon, move to the suburbs, and before the dance is over, they are in the middle of an expensive divorce and they do not know her name. Okay? How we work. That's how we work. And if you try and sit down on top of the very things and energies that flow out of you, you're going to get crazy. I have seen more lives saved in Alcoholics Anonymous as a result of emotional involvement than reading the big book in early sobriety. Because for a hell of a lot of us, the only way we know to relate to the opposite sex is to fuck them. Okay? As cold-blooded as it sounds, it's all we know. I heard an old man say in an AA meeting, my third or fourth AA meeting, how the hell do you take a woman to a motel on a couple of cokes? I was still new. I was still too sick. I thought that was a stupid question. Didn't make any sense to me. It was like, oh, yeah, shit, who cares? You know, a couple of weeks later, I'm starting to feel a little better. You know, I've been eating for a week. I've put 5 pounds on. Things are starting to happen inside again. Suddenly, I remember what he said. How the hell do you take a lady to a motel on 2 cokes? What do? My life was saved because I was picked up. Thank God for small favors. Yeah. The continuing flow of Eskimo. When I was 3 weeks sober, they asked me to give a 10-minute talk. Sitting in the audience of the meeting was this lovely young lady who misinterpreted what her sponsor had told her. Her sponsor told her, she said, if you hear anything you like, take it home. I
She was my kind of people. She was mentally ill. She was 3 months sober, and she took me home, man. And I went, too, you know.
All right. Thank God. I couldn't have talked to her, you know.
I was really grateful because if it had been left up to me to say hi.
Forget it. Wasn't ready for that. We spent about a week together, and then, as life would have it, she had a complete mental breakdown. Was placed in a private psychiatric wing of the Methodist Hospital in Arcadia. Now, I didn't have a sponsor yet. I didn't know what to do. I mean, here we had been sleeping together, and she's sitting out here in the nut ward, right? And I feel an overwhelming sense of responsibility, immense. So the only thing I can figure to do is go visit, daily, right? And I say this, but it's true. I went and visited every day, and every day I took a get-well card. I know, it is sick, but I did not know it at the time, okay? It made sense to me at the time. Hospital, mental ward, who the fuck cares, you take a get-well card. Because that was my sincere wish. I wanted her to get well, you know. If she was well, she would not have been where she was, you know. Now, we would sit around the swimming pool in this swanky private psychiatric unit, and we would hold hands and plan the rest of our lives together with God, AA, and the big book, okay? Yeah. I didn't have a sponsor. I didn't know any better. Made sense to me. There's a whole street, man, runs right down the center of me, called Injustice Collector. Alright? You know, you fuck with the little man in the institution, and I will send you to the hospital. And I don't even like the little man you fuck with. But it's a streak. You give me a damsel in distress, I will mount the white charger, man. Ride through tons of shit to get there. Okay? My sponsor used to use this against me when I was new. He'd find some broad with a gun-carrying, insane, drunken husband who had 3 days of sobriety and wanted to move out. And he'd say, hey, go help her, man. Right? Well, when you're crazy, you do what you're supposed to do. In AA's best tradition, you kick the fucking door in, you take the gun away from the man, tell him you're going to blow his balls off if he sneezes, help her move, leave, and fall in the name of God, love, AA, we care, you know. Anyhow, after a couple of weeks in this private psychiatric unit, she was allowed to come home, and I moved in. I didn't have any place to live. You know, where the hell else do you go, right? Very practical scene. But, above and beyond that, I used to think that this was a sick situation. I used to think it was a sick relationship. I used to think it was a sad thing that had happened to her and to I. And when I was about 8 or 9 years sober, one night I was sitting down talking to somebody, sharing what had happened between she and I in the beginnings of sobriety. And it dawned on me, man, like a floodlight, that we saved each other's lives. And I'll tell you how we saved each other's lives. We got back home. She's frightened and trusts everybody. Now, nobody is talking to me, and I'm hostile and don't trust anybody. And I'm not talking to the people at the meeting. I'm taking my chair, picking it up, putting it against the wall, sitting. Don't want nobody fucking with me. I ain't going to talk to them. You let me be, I'll be fine. Live my whole life that way. Now I got hurt, see? I can't do that. I mean, you can't be slick and cool and pick up 2 chairs and carry them all the way over and put them against the wall. Something about 2 chairs just makes the whole thing ridiculous, right? 1 chair is cool. 2, looks bad. Now I got to sit with the rest of the people, see? Because I got her. And because she's weak and trusting, I make sure that we go to at least 9 meetings a week. At least. I make sure that we read the 24-hour-a-day book every morning for her. I make sure that we read the big book every day for her. I make sure that every night before we go to bed, we read the 12 and 12. for her. Okay? Now, after a while, we would have problems with our relationship. It's interesting how we would react to it. We both would just sort of quit from functioning with people. Now, I can truthfully say this lady could quit better than anybody I have ever seen in my life. Before or since, I have never seen anyone who could quit like Joyce could quit. She could sit down, walk out of the bedroom, sit down in a chair in the living room naked and not move for 3 days. She quit. That's it. She put in all she's going to put in. Quit. I had a sponsor one day walked in the house, looked at her, smiled, said, "What are you today, dear? Carrots or cabbage?" You know. Walked on, you know. But I'm living there, see? So, you know. My solution would be just get kind of shabby, not shave, not shower, not do anything. You'd look like a bum. After a little period of time like this, we would look at each other, and some rationale would come forward. We'd say, "What in the hell are we doing? Why don't we just split up and give each other a chance?" And we would split up. Now, I was brought up in AA that if you dissolve a relationship, you being the male, to take it upon yourself to go to other meetings elsewhere in another section of town and allow the lady to be free and comfortable with the people that she's come to know. A lot of advantages to that, too, guys. You get to meet new people across town. And you learn how big AA really is instead of how limited maybe you think it is by its size. Now, we would be going around to separate meetings and sort of running around for a couple of months, and then we'd run into each other at a meeting. Well, now she's loose again, right? But she's no longer sitting, quitting. She's looking like a million goddamn dollars, man. Dressed up, looking good. Come walking in the meeting, and I'm like, right? Well, the same thing applies for the kid, okay? The kid is on the make again. I am shaving, showering, combing my hair, looking good, wearing the best clothes I've got. Me. We would take one look at each other in this state, and we would say, "The hell did we split up for?" You know, I mean, you're it. And so we would go back together. Right? We did this 6 times, guys. 6 fucking times. I can't believe it. The last time we went back together, my sponsor said, "Do not call me when you leave. I do not want to hear from you when you leave." For whatever reason, apparently it was necessary for us to go through that up to a couple of years. Now, we go through a few fleeting relationships, and we come up to about 5 years sober. Started to write. 2 years before that, I signed my daughters away for adoption because my wife had remarried. And after a year or so, he wanted to adopt them, and I went for it. I guess I'm not fine. I'm not 5 years sober. So I knew the lady has 2 children. And I'm thinking, it all really just made a lot of sense. You know, it's a couple of kids to raise. I've been alone now, or at least single for 3 years, maybe. It's kind of like, I don't know, you know, it was part of trying to become a good credit app, I guess. In order to be a good credit app, you got to have a wife, doesn't hurt to have a couple of kids, got to be at the same address, same job, you know, I mean, in other words, it's kind of nice to pull all this together, you know. Plus, there were some very strong feelings about the lady. Cannot deny that there were some strong feelings about the lady. So we get married. I become super stepfather. Okay? Jesus, incredible. Kids had a problem, I was there. Kids get in trouble at school, I would go. Okay? I mean, it was like, whatever, wherever, there I was on my white charger one more time. Man, gonna fix this for everybody. I've since shot my horse, if anybody's interested. Took about 13 years to kill the son of a bitch, but... Funny, isn't it, Cougar Mountie? That bitch gets old. Anyway... About the time after we had about a year together, I guess, seems like that, I started to feel funny about the situation. I don't know how to explain it. I can't put it into words. I just felt strange. Not miserable. Not really upset. Just sort of But having been the bad guy all my life, having been the one in the wrong, according to society, all of my life, it only followed that this feeling I was beginning to have in this perfect situation was a result of my own inadequacy or something. Because if you ask my friends who were telling me willingly, voluntarily, I had it made. I had a great-looking old lady, two dynamite stepchildren, everything was great. Lady looks at me and says, why don't we move out of the valley? Why don't we get out in the country where the air is clean, where there's no dope in school, kids will have a chance. It doesn't feel well. My head, however, has always wanted to move me to the country. It's been a big thing. Let us move to the country. We should live in the country. I mean, I am righteously raised dead in the heart of the city of Los Angeles. And this thing says, let us go live in the country. I don't like the fucking country. I do not camp out. I do not backpack. I will not sleep on the goddamn ground, man. I love to four-wheel, but when I four-wheel, I headquarter at the Ramada Inn in Kingman, Arizona. So when the day is done and I drag my weary bones in off the desert, I have air conditioning and hot and cold water and a restaurant to go eat in instead of a fucking camp stove to cook on. So, when my head says to me we should live in the country, part of its reasoning always was, God is in the country. God lives in the country with the farmers, with the good people. The cities in the Sodom and Gomorrah of the 70s, we're on our own. The farmers, they can get up in the morning and say, good morning, God. God says, good morning, farmers. What can I do for you? I have a lot of time because I'm not fucking with those poor people in the city. I used to go crazy behind, well, you know, as funny as it sounds, and it's very funny, but I used to go crazy behind that one. I, honest to God, believed it. I really believed it. Until I finally hit a thing in one of the books that I read, by one of the prophets that I read, one of the mystics that I read, that said that the next time that you see a city, see God. The next time you look at a city, understand that that city is God, built by God for his children. Know that that city was created by God in the minds of the architects and the engineers, and then transmitted into being through the hands of the plumbers and the carpenters and the masons and all the people. And so the next time that you see a city, see God. The next time I drove through downtown Los Angeles, I was awed. Absolutely awed. I looked at downtown Los Angeles and said, God, would you look at that? Built by him for his kids? He does live in the city. Today, an excellent yardstick of my spiritual awareness for me is when I'm driving through the interchange in Los Angeles and I look out at that city. And if I look at that city and all I see is crime and smog and dirty streets and old buildings, I'm not in a good place. And if I drive through that interchange and I see the most magnificent city in this world, built by God for his kids, I'm in a good place. Okay? I can relax and enjoy it. But anyhow, I am 5 years or 6 years sober, and I have a lady who wants to move to the country. And it doesn't feel right, but I say, well, let's go look. So we go out to Newhall, Saugus. This is like 1967. It still was nothing out in Newhall, Saugus area. We look around for half a day, and we're standing in front of this house, and she says, I want that house. I look at that house,
I don't know. You know, it just doesn't feel right. So I've been a bad guy all my life. I've been in the wrong all my life. I'm doing as good as I can now. I must owe it to this lady to get her this house because there we are. And she says, I want this house. So I set out to buy her that house. Normally, escrow is a relatively simple, uncomplicated thing. This escrow became the single biggest project I have ever taken on in my life. By the time I finally owned that house, I had made 175 goddamn phone calls. I had gone through attorneys, through title companies. I had to borrow extra money. I did everything but move the house. Like that. But I got in. Well, because she wanted the house. We were in the house a couple of weeks, and it rained. No big deal. Except I walked out in the backyard in the morning, and I looked, and I noticed that I was looking at the bottom underneath of my neighbor's swimming pool. And the reason I was looking at the bottom underneath of my neighbor's swimming pool is that the hill had come down into my yard. Okay? Well, we called the building inspector, and he said, no, nothing to worry about, but don't let the kids sleep in the back bedroom. I said, would you put that in writing? And he said, no. All right. Okay. 2 days later, it rains again. Walk out in the backyard, and the 4x4s are holding up the lanai, which is sitting on top of concrete pyramids, and sunk a foot and a half into the ground. And I noticed the house started to move. Right? Well, it wasn't all that tragic. I mean, I had the people that sold me the house in the palm of my hand. It was sold to me by a real estate agent on the program. Isn't that interesting? Anyway, I mean, I was able to prove that they knew everything that was wrong. It was like the whole area was a geological disaster. Everybody knew it was a geological disaster. First-year geology students know that the Min Canyon area is a geological disaster because it's still moving underneath. And so it's constantly shifting. There are people with homes in that area who have hot sulfur springs in their bar coming up through the floor, man. You know, it's like, it's that kind of area. So I get my money back. But she wants to stay in the country. I don't feel that good. So we go look for another house. I said, screw this section of town. Let us go to the old section of town. So we go to the older section of town. And we find this great house, big trees. And I'm saying to her, I'm not buying another house. I have owned probably my one piece of property for my lifetime. Lease option, maybe, owning. All right, I just watched my house moving slowly down the hill. Decided that there wasn't a lot of, you know, sense in owning. And while I'm walking around this house with a real estate agent, I look over the backyard fence. Now remember, I'm a city boy, okay? Now there's a creek bed there, and there's about 20 feet between my backyard fence and the neighbor's backyard fence, and it's about 8 feet down, okay? Being a city boy, I'm curious as to what the hell it is, so I asked the real estate broker, I say, what is it? He says, nothing to worry about, old dry creek bed. Right? Well, who am I to argue with a real estate man? So he takes this house. I don't like this house. I don't feel that well. I'm starting to have trouble now communicating with the family. I've started to build model tanks as sort of a way to avoid my family. I started with a simple little 295 plastic tank, like that. But if I don't feel good, and the only time I do feel good, although there's a lot of insane energy, it's when I'm building my tank. Now the kids can't touch the fucking tanks, right? Don't touch the tanks. Well, I kept building bigger tanks and more expensive tanks until by the time I got through building tanks, I had built 50 and the last one was this big. Okay? It cost
small piece of change to buy. I shifted gears going uphill. Would go through 1x6. That was a good tank. He probably could have mounted a small caliber revolver in it and right through the neighbor's right yard. Okay. I'm escaping that way. Another thing I discover is I'm living with someone who's paranoid. Now, about prowlers. My sponges, when I came here, I didn't have any, so they didn't make me give them up, but they said, hey, you came from where you came from, you live the way you live, you can never own a weapon again as long as you live. Your guns and you should never be together again. But I'm living with a lady who is really paranoid about prowlers. I mean, she can hear a leaf fall out of the tree in the yard at night. Have you ever noticed how things sneak up on you? One night I go to bed and I lay down next to her and it dawns on me that I am the proud owner of two Dobermans, one in the house and one in the yard, that there is a loaded 12-gauge shotgun minus the thing that, whatever, now I can't remember, up to 6 shots, under the bed, one in the chamber, 5 in the cage, okay? Under the pillow, loaded revolver. I looked at my wife and I said, do you know what's going to happen here? I said, on the off chance, some poor desperate dope fiend gets past the Doberman in the yard, past the Doberman in the house, I am going to blow the motherfucker out of his socks over a television set. I am setting myself up to take a human life to protect the TV set. And I don't want to live like that. She convinced me that she was safe. Well, after that little discussion and after my tank building had come to an end, we had what was laughingly referred to in 1967, I guess it was, or 60, or whenever the hell it was, as the Newhall Malibu Fire. Alright? Started in Newhall, made its way all the way to Malibu. It was a good fire. Big fire. That was old stand on the roof with the whole time, right, keep the place from burning to the ground. I'm not feeling well. You know, I don't like the country, my work isn't going well, the kids may not be into dope, but they're not really doing all that well. And one day I got up in the morning and I walked into the den, and I spent the whole day in the den curled up in a ball on the floor with one of my Dobermans. And I just talked to him all day long. That night when she came in to tell me dinner was ready, I got up, I walked out in the kitchen, and I said, you know what? I said, I think we have a problem. I said, when the only comfortable place in a house this size a grown man can find is in the corner in the den, curled up on the floor in a ball, talking to his dog for 8 goddamn hours, something's wrong. You know, and I accept the fact I'm mentally ill, something's still wrong, okay? She looked at me and smiled and said, everything's fine. The children are happy, I'm happy. We've got this house. All my friends are driving out to visit, telling me how great the house is, the trees are, the country, the fresh air, right? How great the marriage is, how beautiful the children look. So when she's saying this to me, I'm telling her I know something's wrong because I just came out 8 hours from the floor. And she says, I'm happy and the children are happy. And I immediately say to myself, one more time, I'm the bad guy. One more time, there's something wrong with me. How come always me? She's happy, the kids are happy, my friends think it's terrific, everybody is thrilled, and I'm the one who doesn't feel good. I'm the bad guy. One more time. After the fire, it rained. Once again, I discovered that the real estate agent had lied to me. It was not an old, dry creek bed. It was the south fork of the Santa Clarita River, and when it crested at 8 feet over the backyard fence, and we were being evacuated in a flood control jeep, I was beginning to wonder, why am I still here? You know, I mean, I've had a moving house, a sinking house, a fire, and now the flood, right? And I returned home and shoveled the mud out of the garage because my lady was happy. The children were happy. My friends said I was happy. My friends said that the air was clean, the weather was nice, the house was pretty, and what's a little flood? Because they were in the Jeep, man, splitting down the highway, you know, water, but that's beside the point. See? Everything is fine. I don't feel well. I can't explain it, but I don't feel good. I suddenly realize I don't really care what happens to the kid. Not right now. I don't really care what happens to her. But she's still happy. And the kids are still happy. My friends still say it's fine. So if you have that many people, I must be wrong. Even though I feel as bad as I feel, I must be wrong. Because no one is agreeing with me. The kids aren't agreeing with me. My wife isn't agreeing with me. My AA friends aren't agreeing with me. My country neighbors aren't agreeing with me. I must be wrong. Because I just can't handle anything good. Must be why I feel so bad inside. I went through a couple, three more weeks of this, however long it was. Finally, I felt so bad I couldn't stand it. And I said, I've got to go away and write some inventory or do something because I'm getting very strange. I was getting, I knew things were not working well. So I drove down to Laguna Beach. I spent about 3 or 4 days in a hotel. Didn't contact anybody I knew in Laguna, and I had lived there for 2 years. Didn't call folks. Wrote inventory, walked on the beach, read the book, read a couple of other books, spiritual books, and I couldn't understand. And I'd walk on the beach, and I'd think, what's wrong with me? Why can't I fit in this relationship? According to the whole fucking world, it's perfect. And I'm the goddamn square peg in a round hole. And I'm driving back finally after 3 days on a Sunday night from Laguna Beach to Newhall. And I'm screaming in my car at the top of my lungs. I'm saying, God, do something! I can't stand it! 6 a.m. the next morning was the earthquake. As I am flying through the air out of my bed towards the wall, hearing this roaring sound, a little right on top of the center of that sucker, I got the family in the doorway and did all the thing, and finally it quit doing its thing, and I learned there's a couple of good lessons there for me. One was ego, because I honest to God walked through the house, while I was saying something smaller would have been sufficient for a time. Apparently something smaller wouldn't be sufficient. I had already been through a moving house, a major fire, and a flood. I was still there. I wonder what's wrong with me, man. It's everybody's right but me, And the other thing it taught me was about material possessions. There's nothing like an earthquake. It being near the center of it could just clean house for you. No more china hutches to worry about. No more antique lamps to worry about. If rolls the paintings off the wall, rips them on the corner table, it was nothing. Just shattered glass. Felt good, even though I killed myself getting half that stuff. They had originally been from New York. They had never been in an earthquake. We spent a couple of weeks getting everybody comfortable, relaxed, and cooled down after the earthquake. And I got up one morning and I looked at this lady after 2 more weeks and I said, I don't know why, but I must go. I know if I stay, I will die. And that's all I know. And I know it may not make sense to you, and it may not make sense to the kids, and it may not make sense to my friends, but I got to go or I'm going to die. And I threw a bag in the car and boy. I'd like to say I got out totally there, but I didn't, because she knew where all my guilt buttons were. And when she got bored with being out there and we were all alone and decided she wanted to move to the valley, she began to going to commit suicide. I left all the guns. Big mistake. She'd call me at 3 o'clock in the morning, click the safety off the revolver on the phone, and then stick up her mouth and talk to me. She's on the program. She knew it worked, right? Driving back to Newhall, 4 a.m., you know, one more time on my white Charger. I had to do it. Didn't know any other way to handle it. Well, that ends that relationship, number two. Number three. Number three is, in its own way, unique and special and a lot of things. I really don't know if it serves a purpose in a relationship. Of course it does. I mean, Jesus. Side me out. Listen to who's talking to me up here, not always on your side or mine. Part of the thing I was having in the search for God was that I don't know about it. It's like, yeah, okay. Oh, why not? I love this story. I'll tell it. I haven't told it in a long time. I always knew that somewhere I would find her. I mean, I knew that she was the answer. I knew someday I would find her. And one time I've been talking with a really good friend of mine about this one time, and he brought me a tape from an album, an LP. And this guy, and he told the story in concert because he knew I would really appreciate this story. The guy who's telling the story says, imagine you're in Southern California, you're breezing along the freeway system in the fast lane, four lanes over, next to the fence, you're smoking along. And suddenly you look off on the right side of the road up ahead, and there stands this stone little fox in a tiny short skirt, very tight little blouse, and a suitcase by her side. And she's holding up a sign that very simply says, please. He said, so you immediately broadside across four lanes of freeway, attempt to bring your car to a cool, relaxed, you know, together stop with the bumper digging up the asphalt, man. He just bring it to a halt. You lean over, roll down the window, and you smile at her, you say, hi. Where are you going? And she looks in and smiles at you and says, I'm going to Seattle. Hey, you look at her and you throw your best Robert Redford smile on her and say, well, hell, I was just going for cigarettes, but I'll take you to Seattle. Always loved that story. Anyway, at least I don't get emotionally involved, right? Of course I'll drive 1,000 miles. Who the hell cares? It's not important. My job or anything else. One night I showed up 3 months late to talk at a meeting. Interesting, because I believe all timing is God. The reason I was late is because of the flood. I was supposed to have been there, but the flood kept me from going. So I had to change the speaking date 3 months later. Then I went down to Palm Springs and I talked to this leader, and he was kind of standing there after the meeting, and people were going by and shaking my hand, and I'm shaking their hand. And suddenly I feel his hand in mine, and a voice says, hi, I'm Taylor. Thank you very much for your talk. And I just looked up, and I looked in there, and she was. This was the lady I had looked for all of my bloody life. She looked at me, and I was the answer, the solution of the guy she had looked for all her life. The people who were standing around us at the time that we met and shook hands said, goddamn energy, and sparks just went in all directions at that meeting. Well, we had a few things to straighten out. She was in the middle of a divorce, which caused me on one occasion to reload my shotgun. Caused me to get rid of it, too. Lou Foster Ron is a really good friend of mine. We're sharing an apartment. And her ex, Taylor's ex, was giving her a lot of problems, and I had come up with a solution that I had all my life with people who got in my way on the streets. It's very simple. You take a shotgun and you blow their fucking knees out from underneath them, and it's no longer a problem. They become extremely cooperative to your point of view. From that point on, I'm sitting on my bed 9 years sober loading the shotgun. Ron walked through the room, looked at me, and smiled and said, I think you have holes in your program. Then I walked out, you know, sitting there, you know. And I said, see, you know, he's really right. Something's wrong, man. I got rid of it that afternoon. Yeah, we flew We smoothed all that stuff out, and we, for some strange reason, I probably don't understand it till today, we had, it's got to be the best, one of the best relationships I have ever been privileged to be around, much less be involved in. Now, there is a lot more to it. The lady taught me a lot. The lady taught me a lot. Probably the thing she taught me the most about was love. And it was the thing I understood the least. I can remember we went away for our first weekend together to Laguna Beach. And she packed like she was going to the south of France. But I picked a bad weekend because it was April. And it was Easter week. Okay? And the hotel I had gotten a room at was wall to wall with college kids. Now, I'm already carrying this 14 bags she had brought with her for the weekend. And these kids, man, were drinking beer and running up and down the outside corridors and jumping into the pool and chasing the frogs. And, I'm going mad, right? I'm carrying the bags into the room and I'm getting insane. I'm thinking, I wanted to be alone with her. I wanted to be away and be private and be alone. And these fucking animals are going to ruin my weekend. And I'm just sitting there saying, God damn it, I'm in the chair in the living room. I'm inside. I'm just going insane. I mean, maybe if I go outside and punch the lights out of two of them, the rest of them will get the fuck out of the floor. She walks into the next room, grinning ear to ear. She says, isn't that great? She walks into the next room, grinning ear to ear. She says, isn't that great? She said, listen to them kids have a good time. Oh, my God. And I hadn't said a word. All this was going on inside. I just felt so bad. I really thought, oh, Jesus Christ. There's another point of view. And it was like, from that point on, we had a dynamite weekend. We got along with the kids. They got along with us. They loved her. We loved them. They stopped and chit-chat, drink a little beer, chase a few girls. We had a great time. About 12 o'clock at night when we crashed, it was almost like that floor was off limits. There'd never be another time. It's almost like instinctively, without a word being said, they knew that we needed our privacy. She taught everybody I knew about love. Would that be a safe statement? You knew her all the time I knew her. I'm trying to think of anything else. I mean, I gained a lot out of it. Well, anyhow, we dated for a couple of years, each maintaining our own residence, although I might spend 3 weeks to 5 weeks at hers, and she might spend 2 to 3 weeks at mine. After 2 years, we decided, we sat down, and we thought, things might just be good enough that we could get married. Because there's a lot of good legal reasons for us to be married. Just practical reasons, besides emotional reasons. We weren't sure it was the right thing to do or not. So we went away to Unity in Missouri. And we took a little room in a motel there on the ground, Unity Village. And we walked and we talked. And we talked to a couple of ministers, and we chatted, and we decided, yes, most assuredly it was time. We came back. This time I was happy, and she was happy, and my friends were happy. It was like, hey, okay, all right, of all the people, these two should be together. So we moved to Laguna Beach in December of 1972, and we bought a house. And in January 6, 1973, we were married. She wasn't feeling well. On February 7th, she went into the hospital. On February 10th, we learned she had cancer. On April 23rd, 4 months later, she died. I could go into some Eskimos there, too. Don't really know what the rest of the... Yeah, I guess I don't know. Does it have anything to do with relationships? Hmm? the doctor, we had everybody around us that we needed. Our family physician was a member of this program and a personal friend of many years of mine. Sweet guy. He was so devastated when he knew that she had cancer that when he came in the room to tell us, he broke down and cried. I think what she said to me after he left the room probably sums her up better than anything I could ever say. He walked out of the room and she smiled at me and she said, "My God, we're going to have to hold our position up while we go through this." And I just said, "I don't believe it. I don't believe it. The man just told her she's going to die." And her attitude is, "Jesus, he hurt so bad."
This is going to be a funny meeting. Something happened.
All right, let's take it to the Eskimos. We decided about, we want to see the appropriate specialist that you're supposed to see, and it was a joke for her, and she didn't get much out of it. When they explained the treatment to him, I almost should tell the story, and yet I don't know if it serves any. The lady was a magnificent looking lady. She was wearing an old sweatshirt, beat up tennis shoes and jeans, and looked like she had a $1 million. No one would question that she had. Conversely, when she was dressed to the teeth, you knew, all right, that she would overwhelm a room of people. I used to love it, going to a restaurant, right? Yeah.
Look, what, who I brought.
Anyway. Anyway, we went to speak with the oncologist who was a specialist, and he explained treatment to her, and she had this strange expression on her face, and he said, "I don't think you're listening," and she said, "I'm listening," and he said, "What is your opinion?" And she said, "Fuck off." Sitting there just as elegant as she could be, and she said, "I'm terribly sorry." She said, "First of all, if I have to sum it up very simply for you, I am too vain to buy a wig. I lose my hair." And she said, "Secondly, I firmly believe more than anything else in this world that if it is time for me to go home, my father will take me home, and if it's time for me to stay, I will stay. And you have no power in it one way or the other." So that is kind of where we left it. That is a decision I felt that it was not necessary for me to mix them around in one way or the other. I really felt I didn't have a say. So we decided what we needed to do was to go to back to Unity Village, where we like what they say and we like the people that are back there. So we got ready to jump a plane, but we had problems. We had a dog now. We had to get rid of the dog. So I had my parents come get the dog. We had a 3-story house in the hills, and it was wall-to-wall plants. They loved life. Who the hell are we going to get to take care of the plant? And we're sitting there, we're due to leave the next morning, and we have nobody to take care of the plant. We're beginning to think, maybe we're not supposed to go to Unity, because there's nobody to take care of the damn plant. My attitude, of course, at this time of point is, for the plants, you know, let them die, we'll buy new ones when we get back, you know. Phone rings. A friend of mine and his girlfriend just drove in from Kansas City. Just came down Laguna Canyon Road and stopped at the AA clubhouse to call. Don't have a place to stay. Moving to Laguna permanently. And I said, "Hey," right? "Come on. All you gotta do is water some plants, and there's a whole goddamn floor of the house belongs to you." And they came and they stayed. And they stayed through all of it with us. And it was great. Cindy and I are both drug addicts. And when Taylor decided to go for some of the medication not allowed in this country, it required an immense amount of IV. And there's nobody better in the world to give IVs all day long than two ex-drug addicts. We never miss the vein. There's a lot of lessons for all of us in that house. I guess there's the other story about conduct. I haven't told it in a long time. One of the things that the ministers taught me when we went back to Unity for the second time is they said, hold to the idea that everything is in absolute perfect order. You do not know where she's going to go home. You do not know where she's going to stay. You do not know anything. Only hold to the perfection of this moment. Through the power and the grace of God, I was able to hold to the perfection of this moment, and as you asked me on any given occasion if the lady was going to die, I would have said, "I do not believe so." I would have said, "I do not believe so." But I flew, you know. Hmm. It's not really a talk I planned on giving. Well, anyway, in April of 1973, we were down in a clinic in San Diego. And we had put her in there, I thought, to take care of a small dehydration problem that we had run into. By now, it had been a long 3.5 months. There had been no sex of any kind between us. A lot of conversations, a lot of closeness, immense amount of love, but no actual physical contact. I left this hospital about midnight the night she was asleep and went back to my hotel room in San Diego. This is really an example of God will take care of you even when you don't want to be taken care of, I guess. I don't know. Anyhow, I got back to my hotel room and I began to think. And I thought, you know, my head is saying to me, God, it's been a long time, and there's been no physical contact. And, you know, you're in the massage parlor capital of the goddamn world, you know? And what the hell if you just take enough time for some insignificant, non-emotional little roll in the hay for a few bucks? Take some of the pressure off of yourself. Made sense to me, man. It's been a long time. Went and got the Yellow Pages. I don't know if you've ever looked up massage parlors in the Yellow Pages in San Diego, but it's interesting reading. There are pages of it. I find an ad, and I look at it, and it sounds good, and they make house calls, and I go to the telephone, and I can't dial. I can't dial. Okay? I know what that means. I picked the wrong ad. Okay. I go back to the Yellow Pages and I find another ad. Makes house call. And I go back to my telephone again and I can't dial again. I went through this until probably 5 o'clock in the morning. I went from ad to ad and back to the phone and I wanted to call. And I knew that I, by now, had earned them sending somebody to me to take some of this pressure off of me. And I never could call. And finally, when I got so tired, I couldn't see straight anymore. I went to bed and went to sleep. 2 hours later, at 7 o'clock that morning, the phone rang. The nurse said, the doctor said you would be instructed of any changes in your wife's condition and she will not live through the day. I went whippo. Right over the edge. Went to the hospital. I learned by now through all the experiences we had had for 4 months not to listen to the nurses. Cornered the doctor in the hallway and said, I just talked with the nurse, and he said, yes. I instructed her to call you, and he said, in my best professional opinion, she will not live out this day. Two things happened to me. The first was one of immense anger. I took him by his collars and I told him if she died, he'd die. All right? Sorry, that's all I know. That's where I come from. You give me that kind of pain and I'm going to come back with death. That's all I know. I don't know any other way. I didn't know. I let go pretty quick. I'm still angry. The next thought that flashed through my mind was, thank God, I didn't spend my lady's last night on earth with some broad from a massage parlor. Yeah, he really takes care of you even when you don't want to be taken care of. That's neat. I really dig that. Well, anyhow, the rest of it, I guess, there's more Eskimos in here. I immediately ran to a telephone. I called Cindy, who was staying at our house in Laguna Beach, and I asked her to call two men that I knew in Alcoholics Anonymous. Interesting thing is, I was probably as close to killing somebody as I have been on other than two occasions in my sobriety. And yet I asked for the two most gentle men I know in AA. Neither one, the two of them together, could not physically restrain me if they had a gun. Okay? Very, very gentle men. See, our
feel very fortunate to be part of this family. The AA family. And I believe that within the big AA family, over the years, we developed a little AA family of people. I don't think it's separation. I don't think it's isolation. I don't think it's exclusion. I think we just are drawn to people, and we are trying to find the same God. We're trying to walk the same spiritual path. We're trying to share the same things, and we come together. You come to know that you can call on members of your inner family in AA, and they belong to you in a time of crisis. Now, one man who I called, the vice president of a major importing-exporting firm, Cindy reached him in his office, forgot that his wife had given her a message to give him after she hung up. She immediately picked the phone up and dialed him back. About 90 seconds has gone by. He had already left. Good outfit, eh? The other guy's in Palm Springs, and he came from there. Well, here we go. Can't stand distractions like the watch. Anyway, they arrived at the hospital, and she continued to hang on, and we called for a minister from the little church in Unity. Her ex-husband flew in with his sons to see what he could do for me. This is the guy I was going to kill. No wonder I don't talk about this much. I can't stand. My Capricorn ass cannot stand to be emotional in public. I could use something cold to drink, like a Diet Pepsi and some Kleenex. You know, I will turn that over to whoever. Anyhow. About 9 o'clock that night, the minister came out of the room, and he had spent some time with her, and he said, okay, look, he said, let me tell you something. He said, I'm absolutely, thoroughly convinced, although she apparently is in a coma, she hears and understands every word that is said. He said, now, I don't know if she's going to go on or if she's going to stay here. He said, but I know one thing for sure. He said, have you let her know that you support her decisions? Thanks, man. I appreciate that very much. The family, right? We help each other out. Never thought, cry with that Pepsi and a Kleenex. Look, what the fuck? God, how the mighty have fallen. Pardon me. I will do anything to ease some of the pressure. Jesus. I don't care. We'll see if you leave with the tape in the morning. But you know, this is not the talk I planned on giving before I got up here. It's not even close.
He said, I'll tell you what you got to do. He said, you must go in and you must sit down with your lady and you must tell her that you love her very, very much and that she's hanging on in your behalf and that you support whatever it is she wants to do. And if she wants to live and she wants to stay, she'll live and she'll stay. But if she wants to relax and let go and go home, she will relax and get go home. And he said, but you must let her know. He said, I believe she's hanging on for you.
Now with my lady, and in essence, that's what I said. I said, hey, look, do what you got to do. I support you. Whether you stay or whether you go. I left the room, and 5 minutes later, she quietly passed away. Her ex-husband and I sat down. We began to make funeral arrangements. We had to work them out together. There was 4 sons to be considered. She had some notoriety in Palm Springs, where she had lived 20 years of her life.
Her own request had been be cremated and ashes spread at sea. And she had four sons that we had to consider. And we decided there was a small but very private family plot in Palm Springs, and she would be buried there for her sons, for no other reason than her sons. We made all the arrangements. She had been married to Ernie for 20 years. I saw she had both rings when she went. I did not go back in the room, so my friends took me to the mortuary in Palm Springs. And by the time that she was in slumber, and I had to take the rings anyway, and I walked in the room, and about 15 minutes went by, and suddenly my friends came in to see what the hell had happened to me. They figured I had fainted, I had passed out, I had gone crazy and gone out a side door, but they had not heard a sound. What had happened to me was very good for me, because I was standing there when they came in and they said, "Hey, what the hell is the matter with you?" I said, "Nothing is the matter with me." I had finished putting the rings on her fingers and I said, "And the reason nothing is the matter with me is," I said, "I do not know where Taylor has gone. And I do not know where she is, but I do know where she's not. And it ain't in this box." That's all I can tell you. I knew it for sure. She wasn't there. Didn't know where she was. One of her kids came up with an interesting answer later. Anyhow, that evening, we're having dinner, five or six of my AA family, and myself, and one of them says, "God, it's amazing how well you and her ex-husband have gotten along in handling." And this is the man I'm going to kill, the guy who called me the hippie from Reseda. We had no use for each other from the first time we heard each other's name, and we never spoke to each other for any reason except on the phone, and it was never polite. Okay? She said, "God, it's amazing how you and her are getting along through all the arrangements and the things for the boys and everything else." And Phil, one of the two men who I had called to be at my side at the hospital, looked across the table and he said, "What happened to that funny fucking talk I was going to give, Jesus?" He looked across the table and he said, "I would say that Ernie and Bob getting along is testimony as a fitting last tribute to Taylor, for they are the two men she chose to spend the majority of her life with, drunk and sober." Anyhow, we had a simple service. She had one son who was about 15 years old. We were all very worried about. He was a Capricorn. I am a Capricorn. He was a quiet one. He hadn't cried, hadn't been angry, hadn't shown any emotion, hadn't said a word. There were two older sons and one younger son, and him. We went out to the home in Palm Springs after the funeral service. It's just a simple little thing at the cemetery. And Phil, this friend of mine, by now, everything is done. He has held me up through all of it. Once the services were over, he collapsed. He was devastated by her death. God, what a weird one. Anyway, we were sitting out the house, and the 15-year-old looked at Phil, and he knew Phil, and he knew Phil was in pain. And he knew Phil missed his mother. And he went over to him, and he said, "Hey, relax, it's okay." He said, "You know, couldn't use. And things got old. And he said, I just figure her body got old, tired, of no use. And she laid it down. Went away. God, I hope this is good for somebody, because fucking burying me, it's good for me. Out of the mouth of the quiet 15-year-old. The only reason he was not upset is he understood. See? He understood her perfectly. She lived her whole life that way. If it didn't serve a function, if it wasn't of value, if it didn't serve a purpose, there was nothing in her house that wasn't used. I saw her one time get rid of thousands of dollars worth of jewelry because suddenly she realized she was always aware that it was in the drawer, that she didn't wear it. She said, I can't have anything like that in the house. And he got rid of it. Well, how did I handle this? I can tell you how I handled it. After it was over, I was really mad. I was madder at God than I have ever been at any time in my life. I felt like he had burned me like I had never been burned before. I would have rather been beaten, drugged behind anything than what he had done to me, because I really loved the lady. I felt that that was going to be the magic time for me. So I went through about 7 or 8 months, man. I wouldn't talk to God. I wouldn't pray. And I had tons of spiritual stuff coming in the mail to our house, particularly because of her. And my own, you add the two together, and there's something coming every day from somebody about God or something. And anytime I saw anything and I was aware of its contents, I threw it in the waste basket. Because I was mad. I was really mad. I could talk about more personal things than that. I mean, I don't know. Well, let's go on with it. Yeah, let's talk about some of the bullshit. What time is it? Anyhow. The day after the funeral, I'm sitting at Phil's house down in Palm Springs. They said, I'm going to go out by the pool. I want you to understand the insanity that goes on with me. He said, I'm going to go out by the pool and get some sun. Why don't you join me? And I looked at him and I said, I didn't bring any trunks. She ain't going to town to get a pair of trunks in 5 minutes. I said, just go on out and get your sun. And I walked out 5 minutes later and I said, I'm going to go in town and get some trunks. And I said, I'll tell you why I'm going to go in town and get some trunks. I'm going to go in town and get some fucking trunks because I'm sitting in that house with my head telling me I cannot go lay in the sunshine, because when I go back to Laguna with a suntan, I will not be pale, befitting the tragedy that has just befallen me. I said, screw that. I will go back brown and let the people figure what they want to figure about how I'm handling what's happening in my life. So I went and got some swim trunks, and of course immediately got my ass sunburned off, but that's not too unusual for an extremist.
The next thing I wanted to do more than absolutely anything else in the world was get laid. The strongest drive I had was find somebody and get there.
Well, I didn't know who. I mean, I did not know who. And the phone.
The girl on the other end of the phone and I had been friends for a couple of years, and she was not an AA, she was an Al-Anon, and she said, hey, I just heard about Taylor and I'm terribly, terribly sorry. What can I do? Can I do anything?
I said, yes, as a matter of fact, you can. How would you like to go to Santa Barbara for a day and a night?
We got up to Santa Barbara and, went straight to the room and went straight to the bed to do the thing, and it was a disaster. It was terrible, man. It was just like awkward and uncomfortable, and nothing went right, and I ejaculated too. It was just bad. The whole thing went really bad. Now, this was amazing because she and I had been together before and we had broke the goddamn bed. You know, and this time was a disaster. And finally we looked at each other and we said, you know what? I think what we've got here is a brother and sister who are busy with some incest that should be left for others. And maybe we should be talking. And the minute she said that, I said, yes, you know what?
I said, I have not yet had a chance to tell a woman about my woman. Since the day she passed away, I have been surrounded by men. 10, 12, 15 men, all of my brothers who I loved dearly were there, day in and day out. But I had not sat with a woman and told her what I thought was special about my lady. So that was one of the things I had to go through. Anyway, 6, 7, 8 months after throwing everything spiritual in the trash, after not praying, after being very angry at God, and I really mean angry, I looked at my life and it was shambles. I was trying to sell the goddamn house and the escrow had fallen through and I am living in a very expensive apartment with a very expensive empty house on the hill. I couldn't get a writing assignment to save my life. And in general, things were just kind of going straight downhill. I decided to give God another chance because I didn't know what else to do. I needed somebody to take care of me. I was trying to take care of myself one more time and I couldn't do it. In 2 or 3 months, in another 2 month period of time, after surrendering everything back to God again, the house got rid of fine. I kept the apartment and met a lady who had a 4-month-old baby daughter. The lady's a nice lady. I really dig her, but I fell absolutely, totally, and completely in love with this 4-month-old little girl because somehow new life made the loss of my lady okay. Also, I was beginning to feel like for the first time in my life, I had an angel. For the first time in my life, I had somebody there who cared about me. And what happened to me? The baby was great for me. I mean, you know, 4 months old, right, girls? I mean, this is spit up, changing diapers time, the whole thing, and I am having a ball. Lou and I took her, the 4-month-old, and her mother to San Francisco for the international. And Lou and I and the 4-month-old baby and this gorgeous blonde on the airplane, we drove the whole city insane by the time we were through. Took her to the best restaurants and just hung her backpack on the chair. I didn't, you know, what do I know? I'm not the father. I thought everybody loved kids. I loved her. Why doesn't the restaurant love her? Is Maitre D' going to tell me he ain't going to seat the kid? No, man. Not if he wants the restaurant still there, because I am doing something good, and never fuck with me when I'm doing something good. Anyhow, I think the baby was a major turning point in my life. I don't know. You wouldn't. I would say the baby was a major turning point. I fell in love with new life, and I spent a couple of years loving this kid to death. I couldn't wait for her mother to go to work. Although I adore her mom and I are still great friends, because I got to date babies and the baby. I mean, this is me, man. I'm looking forward to taking care of this little kid, man. He's got something wrong with her diapers every 12 and a half minutes. You know. I mean, it's seed time, like, you know, that kind of thing. And I spent the next 2 years single, and I just married 8 months ago, and my wife is in the process of packing now, and it's okay. We met, and I think it was good for both of us. I learned a hell of a lesson. I keep forgetting that I have an image, and that people deal with the image and don't take the time to get to know the person behind the image. I conversely looked at the image that she presented and thought it was great, you know, and apparently our images don't get along well. I don't know, and it's fine. Because we had a lot of conversations before we got together about the fact that life is now, life is this moment. You see, Taylor and I had made, no wonder I couldn't remember this before. Lou remembers. Taylor and I had made a pact with ourselves before we got married. Boy, thank God we made it too, because it saved me when she passed away. We sat down, we had a long talk, and we agreed that on any given day when one or the other ceased to benefit from the relationship, we would part and go see what God had in store for both of us. We would not either one dare to drag the other one down for a second. And so when she went, I mean, it helped a little, you know, to know that. What the hell else is there to say about me? You know, I mean, I don't really know where this talk is going. What can I tell you? You know, Jesus, I mean, it was a very heavy experience. Out of it, I am closer to, you know, to the people that were around me then, to Lou, who spent $4,000 to make the boat different so I could sail on it and not have to miss my lady. You know.
to the guys who drove hundreds of miles and flew thousands of miles to be at my side when she was dying because they knew I needed her. To the people who looked after me like a baby for the first 2 or 3 weeks because I was too angry and in too much of a fog to deal with anyone. They sensed my immense anger and would step in front of them between me and anybody who happened to say something that they knew would trigger me into some dumb rage. I'll tell you about brothers and friends. Tommy's old man, or ex-old man, I mean Cindy's ex-old man, whatever, Laguna Beach. Cindy's ex-old man, Tommy. At the time that she was going through this, she had to go through some, she went through some kind of purifying kind of thing. She had to quit smoking. And one of the things that she went, Tommy said, hey, well, he sat down with her one day, he said, hey, look, he's not, anyway, he's not too well, like the rest of us. He said, I don't want you ever going through anything alone in this house. He said, so whatever it is they want you to do, you come sit down with me and we'll do it together. And I mean, there were things that she was going to do. There was like, she went through like a purging with Epsom salt of her system. It's a horrible thing, man. I mean, it's really a ghastly thing. But my brother, her brother, my friend, did not hesitate to sit down with her side by side and drink Epsom salt, gallon by gallon, and vomit, vomit by vomit, and lay awake all night like she laid awake and had the pains that she had. Whatever it was asked of her, he did it too. That's AA. That's what I understand the fucking thing should be. You see, not petty bullshit, not who's balling who, not who's emotionally involved with who, you know. It's when you can sit down with your brother, man, or you can sit down with your sister, and you can drink 2.5 gallons of Epsom salt, because you don't want her to do it alone. Hey. That's what's here. That's what we got. And we're going to worry about the rent. You're going to worry about the car? You're going to worry about a repair bill? You're going to worry about a job? The power of God is immense. Immense. The guy who sat down and drank the gallons of Epsom salt has got to be one of the most insane, selfish, self-obsessed people by his own admission I have ever met. Now how does an insane, selfish, self-centered person, one who identifies himself as an ingrown hair when he has a problem in sobriety, because he just gets so self-obsessed he grows right back inside and the rest of the world ceases to exist. Where does he find? Where does he find the love and the freedom and the power to sit down and drink the Epsom salts and drink the baking sodas and drink the juices and drink the things day in and day out and never complain and smile and laugh and have a good time and say, God, lady, this stuff tastes terrible. They say, I know, and they just drink it down together. Where does he get that? That's the kind of power that's here. That's the Father I am talking about. That's the Father I understand. And everybody here, man, we are all his kids. We're all his kids. And if he can love me like he has loved me, and if he can walk me through all of the things he has walked me through, and sometimes his way of walking me through is just bringing all those people in the family right up to my ass and saying, here are your brothers and sisters. Lay down, man. They'll take care of you. Kind of like what you guys were doing before dinner. You know, here are your brothers and sisters. They're going to hold you in their hands. They'll take care of you until you come out the other side. That's what this is all about. I'm sorry. I refuse to worry about anything. God bless you. We'll start tomorrow.